At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Destiny, everybody, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Malay for it's hot in here, which refers to the searing temperatures that we will be encountering in Singapore. Malay, by the way, I've learned is the official language according to the original Singapore Constitution. And since we don't have Malaysia on the calendar anymore, I figured it was fitting to get some Malay language in there. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me is Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Well, now I'm missing Malaysia. That was a good circuit. I could go for that again.
I know. We got F1's only night race coming up, though. Daniel Dwyer, by the way, out on house moving duties, but with us in spirit. If you are new to this podcast, welcome. If you are new to the Formula One sport itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge and gives the lowdown on how the sport works, who everybody is. So if you want to listen to that, this year's primer is episode 59. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Every month we release at least one bonus podcast and bonus video exclusively for our patrons, covering racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, primers for other racing series, a whole lot of weird stuff. So if you want to support the show and get access to all those things, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click on the link in the show notes. We just finally finished up our three-part series on the F1 Netflix documentary Drive to Survive, which was really fun. I enjoyed watching that one again.
I think almost more interesting to discuss now, given that we kind of know how the story ends, that it's setting up at the end of its run. So definitely a good time to revisit it.
Totally. Today, however, we will be discussing the modern news in 2019 and the Singapore Grand Prix. But let's get to that news first, Rob. First, a real quick update on the ongoing, well, no longer ongoing, Haas Rich Energy saga. Haas released a picture of their car for this weekend, what the livery will look like. There is no Rich Energy branding on it whatsoever, but the colors are the same.
And yet there is something a little undeniably more Hearst-like about the entire thing. I gotta be honest. The photo they released, is it that, was the Haas in the gold before instead of the white lettering?
I think it was,
feels less colorful than it was. It was already a pretty dark-looking car, but maybe it's just this like moody, like gloss black backdrop they've got to this this graphic. Yeah, exactly. Because this definitely looks like, you're gonna be loading someone for their last ride into the back of that Haas.
Jeez. Let's see. Yeah, not really much to touch on after that. That partnership is done. Racing Point, speaking of upgrades to cars, what's going on with them?
So this is apparently they're rolling out a major upgrade package, what they're calling a major aero upgrade, which seems to imply that they might be touching more than one component. So they're in an interesting position. So it's clear this is their last major upgrade, and from here it's just going to be a matter of implementation and tuning the upgrades they've already got. But this is very much something that they're hoping is going to help them get an edge in a late season Constructors' Championship fight, which is actually pretty tight. Like, there is a really good fight for fourth in the Constructors and a really good fight for sixth. If things break certain ways, I guess you could say that, you know, fourth is anybody's ball game, but I suspect it's not. So my feeling is that it's going to be kind of coming down between you know, who's gonna end up in fourth and who's gonna fall to sixth. And Racing Point right now is, they just clawed their way ahead of Alfa Romeo, but they are still toward the back of that midfield pack. Sergio Perez made some comments about he thinks they can win that midfield pack, and they think they can be, they like, he's saying, I think we can finish fourth. He says, I think a step of 0.3 on top of what we have is what we need to be regularly the fourth fastest team. But he did say we're close to that goal, but 0.3 is quite a lot, even without considering other teams' development programs. 0.3 is kind of a hand wavy, you know, it depends what 0.3 depends on what track you're running, obviously. But it's a decent yardstick. That does seem like a lot to gain at this stage of the season, and to gain consistently, given how everyone's car seems to be a little bit inconsistent depending on what track you're running. Nevertheless, this feels like their kind of last major throw of the dice for this year. And, you know, they've got a lot riding on it.
Yeah, and you know, you would hope that teams, all the teams, are sort of incrementally improving their cars as well. So the fact that they expect to be ahead of them, given that as well, is impressive, especially considering where they were a year ago. You know, Vijay Mallya getting kicked out, the team being bought, like, that is extremely tumultuous for Formula One team. But here they are in seventh place, only 5 points behind Scuderia Toro Rosso. So yeah, looking forward to that.
Yeah, I think the team that really has to be nervous is Renault, right? Because they're in that close fight with McLaren. Well, close-ish. They're 18 points behind, but they are only 14 ahead of Toro Rosso. So Renault's in kind of this weird position of, they could make a charge at McLaren here at the end of the season, and I know Ricciardo was really complimentary of the team for a strong showing in Monza, where they finished fourth and fifth, I want to say, which, given how things have been for that team, putting those two cars together, you know, in the top five is a pretty huge achievement for that team. So maybe they do have some late season form left in the tank here, and that can help them safely escape that sixth place spot.
Yeah, especially if both of their cars finish without exploding.
So did you see this this thing about there being like an air quality warning for the Singapore GP?
Yeah,
I'll tell you, this is one of those things that definitely, again, like, signs of our changing world and our changing climate. Not to say like air quality warnings haven't frequently happened in the past and in warmer climates and in the tropics, but nevertheless, like, this appears to be becoming a more regular occurrence in different parts of the world. And
happened in my part of the world a few months ago.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds like this one, well, I don't know, you can go a little bit into this. It doesn't sound like it's too dangerous yet, but they're definitely kind of monitoring the situation. They may have to take some steps, right?
Yeah, it sounded like the Singapore government, at least, was like, oh, it'll be fine, but we will have N95 masks on hand at the Grand Prix for, you know, any old people who were having problems.
Old people, people with breathing problems, just, yeah.
Children, old people, people in the middle. Yeah. Is this Autosport here that says, nearby Southeast Asian islands have produced, quote, hotspot activities with smoke plumes that triggered the risk of transboundary haze. So fires, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, you're also in the Ring of Fire around there, so it's possible there have been some, like, volcanic eruptions that didn't make the news particularly much. So that's also always a possibility. But yeah, so that is something that everyone is monitoring and could have ramifications for the drivers as well. I mean, again, we were just doing the end of the Drive to Survive series, and one of the races they cover in that was Singapore, I want to say. And that appears to be maybe the most physically taxing track on the calendar. Like, in Drive to Survive, you see those guys getting out of the car, and you don't know, like, F1 drivers are in incredible shape, and they look just completely wrung out at the end of practice at Singapore. So, you know, that on top of being in a race car, which is already hotter on tarmac, and then if the air quality is bad, I could see that being a very rough race to compete in.
Yeah, agreed. Speaking of eruptions, explosions, what have you discovered about this cryptic message from Binotto to Leclerc?
Yeah, this was a weird thing that had completely gone by me. Racefans.net spotted it, but Matteo Binotto, in his radio message to Leclerc when he won Monza, said, "Oggi sei perdonato," and it means that today you are forgiven. And apparently this all ties back to, and Binotto further clarified, he said, it, when people asked him, what the hell did you mean by that? He said, it means that whatever happened in the last days that we discussed, that's something that will remain between our three. At least today he did a good job. And apparently that is all tied, I presume that is Binotto, Leclerc, and Vettel. Because apparently it all went down, all went back to the Q3 debacle at Monza, where Leclerc was expecting, where Vettel was expecting Leclerc to pull ahead of him and give him the toe around the track so he could set what he hoped to be a pole competitive lap. And Leclerc took too long to do that. And that's why Vettel didn't get his final run in at all. Leclerc eventually did the overtake and started providing that toe, but he left it so late that there wasn't time to get around to timing and scoring. Now, it's not only Ferrari that this got screwed up for, and this is why, like, honestly, this is one of those things. I get self-conscious about, like, always having my hobby horses about the, you know what I mean? You talk about a sport again and again, you feel like you're making the same observations. But this is one of those things that, again, makes me question just what the culture is at Ferrari. That is a kind of a weird, imperious thing to say to a young driver who just won the biggest race of your team's season. Especially for something that I think if you looked back at what happened in Q3, everyone got that wrong. And to a degree, arranging those toes is tough. That's why it's become such a farce every time in Q3. People are trying to, like, nail the timing so that the leading car can sort of pull along the trailing car. Because if you get it wrong, there's kind of an awkward overtake during the hot lap, and or you fall too far behind. It's just a tough sweet spot to find. And everyone got it wrong in Q3. So I just don't fully see the upshot of souring that moment. Why do that?
Yeah, especially when you're balancing the team and the driver dynamics as the team principal. We've actually got an email here from Carolina who says, "Hi, Drew, Denny, and Rob. Big fan of the podcast. Thanks for taking the time to make it. I look forward to it after every race, and I always find it extremely insightful. While I'm not new to F1, my dad and brothers being the complete gearheads of the family, in the last 2 years, I've really started following the sport regularly along with them, and I'm particularly fascinated by the team dynamics. That said, I want to know what you all think about the relationship between Vettel and Leclerc going forward after the Italian GP, and particularly after Q3 when Leclerc failed to give Vettel the toe. How do you think it will all play out? Do you think it could have been a calculated move by Leclerc? If so, do you think he'll come to regret souring the dynamic between himself and Vettel? Thanks for your time, guys. All the best, Carolina."
I mean, there's a lot there, and a lot of it requires trying to peer inside someone's head in ways that I can't find. But after, I do not find this easy. But last week when we discussed Monza, to me it felt like Vettel might be a spent force in F1 right now. So to a degree, like, if there's ever a moment to think, like, I don't really care what Sebastian Vettel makes of me as a teammate, this is probably it. Because the guy sort of tossed last season in the trash through a series of mistakes of his own making. And then this season, The mistakes have been just about as bad, but they've just been less significant because Ferrari's been less competitive overall. He's had a bit of bad luck, but that's been offset by the fact that he did something incredibly risky and dangerous last week, which, setting aside what Ferrari expects, he didn't meet the standard that Formula One expects of its drivers. And then throughout the season, he seemed pretty beaten and demoralized by the lack of pace in the car. So I don't know that this isn't like Schumacher when he was like the Minotaur of Maranello back in the early 2000s. And you had to really be careful, like what Schumi thought of you, because it was clear that if you were not willing to be the appropriate, second fiddle to him, you were going to be on your way out and Ferrari would make you move over. Those days are done. Vettel doesn't have the record and he doesn't have the record in the car, and he doesn't have the infrastructure around him that enabled Schumacher to play that game. And I'm not even convinced Binotto has really established that he's a major force to be reckoned with in the way that like Jean Todt or Ross Brawn were. So if I'm Leclerc, you're hot shit. You're probably the future of the team. And I don't think he's being a jerk about it. I don't think it was necessarily calculated. Like I said, everyone got this wrong. But this is one of those moments where you look and if you think you're right, don't listen to those guys.
Yeah, I'm continually interested in the team dynamic and what actually goes on between teammates. And there was a really illuminating interview with Alexander Albon on F1's Beyond the Grid podcast, which I will link in the show notes. And he's talking about the move from Toro Rosso to Red Bull and kind of what he's had to learn there and what he's learning from Max. And he says, it's not like Max is like, Alex, come over here. Let me show you how to take this corner. It's more like he'll go first in briefings and stuff like this. I'll listen to his comments. I'll listen to how he interprets the car and what he wants to go quicker. Even just listening to how he speaks to the team and how they communicate. So there are these opportunities to learn from your teammate, even if you're not buddy-buddy, right?
Yeah.
And I got to imagine that Leclerc is kind of feeling just like that. Like, he doesn't need to be my friend. And Vettel sounds like a guy that's pretty insular and private. So I don't know that he's really missing much here, Leclerc, by taking matters into his own hands and getting his.
Yeah, I think there's a bigger question of how, like, in addition to the Vettel is seem pretty out of it, I don't think that's just psychologically he's not on his game. Like, I'm also at a point where I do wonder, what's his interest level and attachment to having a great phase of his career at Ferrari? There was a point by the end at McLaren where it no longer seemed like Alonso was really that attached to the job he was doing anymore. I've gotten that feeling sometimes from Vettel in the last year. And I remember seeing an interview with him where he talks about, like, you know, his great passion is repairing his working on his vintage motorcycle when he goes home. Like, to it, like, Sebastian Vettel, for all his reputation as, you know, being kind of a jerk and a competitor, like consummate competitor, it seems the things I've heard from him and the things I've read about him sort of imply that you get him away from the track, he turns into an old dad with hobbies.
Yeah.
And I think he might be at that point where those hobbies might be looking better to him. And if you're Leclerc and you got that fire and it's all ahead of you, I don't know if you're going to back off for him. And I don't know if you're going to back off for Binotto. You know, this is, and yet I think everything about Ferrari feels like team leaders are cosplaying Enzo. And their primary drivers are play acting at being Schumacher.
Speaking of Monza, do you want to follow up with the fallout from Leclerc being shown the black and white flag?
Yeah. So the black and white flag appears to be kind of divisive right now. And we talked about bit about this last week, I want to say, where Michael Massey, the steward who, the race director who replaced Charlie Whiting, when he passed, Massey said, he explained that the black and white flag has become, under his direction, the equivalent of a yellow card. It's the unsportsmanlike conduct flag of racing. It was not used very much, but it is at the race director's discretion as to whether it is used and how it is used. Massey has sort of taken it upon himself to use that to flash in situations where there's been something borderline or unsportsmanlike, but it falls short of being referred to the stewards. And it came up again at Monza when Leclerc kind of forced Hamilton off at the second chicane and he got shown the flag. Didn't really matter that much because at that point he had held the position and Hamilton never mounted a successful challenge after that. But nevertheless, it was kind of a notification that, you know, hey, you're on notice. And people have really intensely strong feelings about it and really different reactions to it. Keith Collentine over at Race Fans posted an article basically arguing that the flag injects this kind of ambiguity into everything. Like his argument is basically that either something is illegal or it isn't. He says that what he says is the black and white flag is only introducing confusion. A move is either black or white, legal or not. The signal is meaningless, and that will be demonstrated as soon as a driver performs a legal move, is shown the black flag for it, then repeats it anyway. But you had seen an article from Will Buxton taking a very different tack, and I'm curious what Will's argument was there.
Yeah, I think he is a little exasperated or confused by the fact that, you know, we were angry for things like Vettel in Canada earning a 5-second penalty, or you know, these big penalties that came down that some people didn't think, or that some people thought were just racing incidents, completely changing the outcome of the race. And so this is sort of a half step measure. It's like a warning, and it's a way to have our cake and eat it too. So he says in this article on Formula1.com, which I will put a link to in the show notes, both sides here. He says there's absolutely nothing wrong or nothing to stop the stewards from looking at the incident for which the race director issued the conduct flag, and determined that it was worthy of actual punishment. So I think that's a key point here. The race director, Massey, is the one who issues the flag. The stewards are the ones that issued the penalties, and they don't have anything to do with each other. So the race director can issue the flag, and the stewards could issue a penalty for that action. He goes on, should the rules have been clearly and gravely breached, it would, after all, be their duty to do so. If the incident itself, however, was judged to be on the limit of acceptability or having crossed so scarcely into the red that a punishment is judged to be too harsh when compared with the infringement, then they may be satisfied that the conduct flag being shown is enough of a shot across the bow.
I think this all points out, everyone seems vaguely dissatisfied with the current status quo, and Massey has introduced a half step to addressing it, but even there, remember when the Canada thing happened, we were sitting there and I can't remember who you were quoting. I think it was one of the Dutch commentators had written a piece about how every time we ask for clear delineation of what rules mean, we take judgment calls out of the equation and we force people, we force things like what happened in Canada. We force rulings that, well, according to the letter we've now established, because everyone wanted clarity, we now have to dock Vettel this time and force him to yield this position. And nobody's happy with that. I was a little more ambivalent about it, but I understand that there was sort of this knee-jerk reaction. The let them race thing is so in the eye of the beholder. It is, I think it is such a meaningless thing to say, because it's let them race until someone breaches an invisible line that then we decide is not fair racing. Here's what worries me. I don't think the flag is the issue. What I think is the issue is that the more drivers draw the conclusion that Leclerc ended up drawing from Austria, the more dangerous the sport gets. After Austria, when Leclerc felt that he had gotten a sharp elbow and driven off the track by Verstappen, and nobody did anything, and Vettel was shown not much mercy for running off and then coming back on, which was also a bit dangerous, but like wasn't necessarily sort of a screw you, I'm going through and I'm not leaving you room move. When Leclerc saw that go down, his reaction after his temper came down, he said, now I understand better what the rules are and I'm going to adjust. He called his shot. He said, I'm going to race differently because of that. And then we saw at Silverstone, he did. And he was extremely on the edge and extremely sharp elbowed with Verstappen again. And here we saw it again with Lewis. And Lewis had said the only thing that stopped him from causing an accident was he was thinking of the championship. He realized he just needs to keep banking his points and he's going to win the championship and it's fine. So he didn't need that spot that badly. But if the situation had been different, Lewis was implying there that if there hadn't been sort of a calming voice in his head that reminded him, oh, there's a bigger picture here. You don't need to win this fight. If he'd sort of either been fighting for a victory that was critical to him, or if he'd just been pissed enough, he would have triggered an accident. And I do think there's an element of F1 racing has always had a problem with there being kind of a chicken-like component to the psychological brinksmanship of racing. And we tend to glamorize it in retrospect, like the Senna documentary treats him like triggering an intentional accident at the start at Suzuka as like kind of a natural and kind of badass moment in his ongoing feud with Alain Prost. But if you take the wider view, every time a driver sort of, and this is what people were saying about Senna at the time, is that he was too on the edge. He was taking advantage of how much safer the racing was these days and sort of pushing things further and further over the limit. Every time you make moves like that, you are kind of forcing the other drivers to concede, like, well, one of us has to be the responsible party here. And I guess it's going to be me and I'm going to concede. And if that concession always leads to you finishing second, competitors are going to decide, screw it. Actually, the thing you got to do is never see that psychological edge. And if somebody threatens a collision, you got to be willing to take it. What Paul Tracy calls, you know, giving him the chrome horn. And when Paul Tracy has a cute catchphrase for something, you know that it's probably not a great idea in open wheel racing.
Yep.
And so that's my objection to this is I've been harping on this for a few weeks. It's just, what do we mean by fair racing? What do we mean about allowing a car's width through a corner? Do these things have literal meaning and, you know, that we intend to enforce? Or is it always going to be this kind of judgment call and in the heat of battle, well, really we should let them race and let it sort it out for themselves. Because then I think over time you're going to see more and more people drawing the lesson Leclerc drew, which is hell with it. You know, make me move.
Yeah. Speaking of the heat of battle, should we take it to Singapore?
Oh yeah.
Oh boy. F1's only night race takes place from 8 to 10 p.m. local time, but which is actually 2 to 4 p.m. Central European time, so it's no different for the drivers. But that means they go to sleep at 5 a.m. local time and have breakfast at 3 p.m. It also means that Free Practice 1 and Free Practice 3 take place during the day because qualifying in the race... and I guess Free Practice 2 drift into the evening. So that kind of messes with your data and makes for a lot of guesswork for the nighttime qualifying and race. So that can lead to some unpredictability. It is one of the longest races in terms of time, because although it's not the longest race, it's 5 kilometers or 3.1 miles. It's relatively slow speed. So the fastest Singapore Grand Prix was 1 hour, 51 minutes. You may know that 2 hours is the limit for a Formula One race. If it exceeds that in terms of time duration, they will shorten the number of laps. And it's also really, really hot and humid. So it's, as you mentioned, Rob, absolutely brutal on the drivers. You might see drivers wearing cool vests, which are like gel things that you can throw in a freezer and then wear. The drivers sweat out 3 kilograms or about 6.5 pounds of water during the race. It's also got the most corners on the calendar. So as a driver, you are busy all of the time, 62 gear changes, and you spend apparently 25% of your time on the brake, which is more than twice as much as Monza. It's a street circuit, so it's very tight. Counterclockwise, the first turn reminds me of Circuit of the Americas without the incline. It's this long start into this flowing back and forth section to the right. I'm sorry, to the left. And then turn 5 is a long right-hander that leads onto the first straight, which actually has a kink in it. So if you can keep the speed up, turn 7 is the first of the good passing opportunities into this heavy braking zone for a 90-degree left-hander. Turn 10 used to be a chicane called the Singapore Sling that had these crazy curves. There's some photos of cars basically becoming airborne as they're going over them. But they removed the chicane in 2013 because of the high chance of damaging cars. There's still a tricky section just after that, which leads into the turn 13 hairpin, which is also important because after that is the other long straight, which heads into turn 14, another great passing opportunity. Then it's kind of cool. You go underneath the stands and into this segment called Esplanade, which is a series of tight turns that looks like if you were racing on an LED number 5, you know, like on a clock radio. It's kind of like a square wave like that. Lots of right angles, and then 2 more slight lefts onto the start-finish straight. What are your impressions of Singapore, the track, Rob?
Yeah, it's not one I like very much in terms of, like, when it comes up in the F1 series, for instance. It's not one of my favorites.
The video game?
Yeah, it's, it is a really demanding and exhausting track. I think it's also a really stressful one because, to me at least, it is kind of featureless, which is funny because the night shots, it is such a distinctive race in terms of the televised presentation. You get those amazing shots of that hotel with the freaking boat across the three towers and
yeah, the infinity pool.
That ridiculous pool. It's a really distinctive venue, but I think, you know, unlike Abu Dhabi, for instance, the distinction vanishes if you're in the car, and it's basically you are just in this Death Star trench run of Armco barriers and fencing. And so it ends up being a track where you really have to have memorized the layout, and really you're relying on those corner markers as your sole point of reference because there's just not a ton of great features on the track. And then it's also a track I associate with, not necessarily scary accidents, but major ones that bring out the safety car. It's a pretty tight track, and there's a lot of places where, so it's tricky. Like, you sighted turn 1, right? Turn 1 is a bit like Coda in that there's a little bit of room on the outside. There's a nice runoff area, and it does kind of flow into 2, and you can kind of cut 2 because that runoff area continues to be the inside of the corner at 2, and they get a really tightening turn into 3. Those are a lot of invitations for people to explore the limits of track adhesion and space on the track, but then at turn 3, it really tightens up fast, and, you know, it's like game musical chairs. If you've gotten it wrong, at somewhere in there, you're going to find out, like, oh, there's just no more room for a car to go, so into the wall. Yeah. That can happen elsewhere, too. So it's a really tricky track from that standpoint as well, because there's a lot of places for somebody to get it wrong, and then you got a car, you know, wrecked on a busy street, and they've got to bring out they've got to bring out a safety car to clear it. So it's not a I associate this with messy racing, but not necessarily dull racing is the funny thing. Like there's some street circuits, Monaco, I'm looking at you, that are, I think, so tight and punishing. They really are hostile to great racing. Here, this is a circuit that is very, that allows just enough room for both people to make interesting mistakes, but also for when people really get their blood up and have really just had enough and want to get past somebody, not naming names. One of them may no longer be in the sport. One of them still is. But if somebody really just gets pissed and is like, I'm coming through, there's a lot of places where it's maybe not a clear passing opportunity, but where there's a will, maybe there's a way. And people try it.
Yeah, I'm recalled as you say that to last year, Sergio Perez hitting Sergei Sorotkin after he passes him, just tries to cut him off, earns a puncture. Also, same race, Perez shunted his teammate Esteban Ocon into a wall.
You know, though, now that in the context of this track being hotter than the fires of hell, mm-hmm. all of this weird stuff makes a little bit more sense to me, too. It's the end of the season. People are like racing for their jobs, and it's like a million degrees.
So they're getting delirious. Yeah. Like they're out in the desert.
Yeah, it's like it's road. It's the Road Rage Grand Prix brought to you by climate change.
Also in that that race, Kevin Magnussen set the record for the fastest race lap. So he still holds that at 1 minute 41.905 in his Ferrari-powered Haas. The year before that was this spectacular crash at the start between Raikkonen, Vettel, and Verstappen. Verstappen basically touched his front wheels to the rear wheels of both of the Ferraris and plowed them into each other. And then Raikkonen's stricken Ferrari went cut the corner and crashed into Alonso. Oh man, I will link that in the show notes as well. It's amazing under the lights. It's quite an incident. It's also the site we've been racing here since 2008, and that very first race it has one of the more infamous moments in Formula One that frankly doesn't get talked about a lot. I think because Formula One doesn't like to bring it up very much. They put on their YouTube channel, like, top five moments from Singapore. I'm like, I think this is one of them. I wasn't around watching Formula One at this point, but do you know more about this? Yeah.
Yeah. So this was during the era when I was having trouble getting the races myself. So I didn't see it happen live. But arguably, this was a championship deciding incident. Because it ended up really disfavoring Felipe Massa, and he lost points in this entire deal that ended up being the margin for him losing to Hamilton at the end of the season at, I think then it was Interlagos. But yeah, so the context for this one was things were no longer going well at Benetton Renault, and Alonso was getting increasingly frustrated. And I want to say the team principal there was also his agent at the time, Flavio Briatore. I think he might have already had that agent representation relationship there as well.
Okay.
A lot of drivers are like really loyal to Flavio, which I always find interesting because he's always seemed like such a shady operator for shit like this. So things are not going well that season. Alonso's getting pissed, and Briatore, by all accounts, is desperate for something good to happen. Nelson Piquet Jr. He was early in his career. I don't know if he's a rookie. Is told he's Alonso's teammate. Is told that, you know, if you crash at a certain point, and we know that's going to happen, we can have this entire thing timed out so that Alonso can win this Grand Prix if we arrange this. And so Piquet had an accident. And I can't remember if Alonso actually did end up winning.
He did, I think.
Okay, yeah. But the thing was,
after starting 15th on the grid. So the crash came out, or the crash happened, the safety car came out, which we know can totally scramble everything.
Right, and so imagine like how powerful it is if you know that a safety car is coming, right? If you knew a lap ahead of time that a safety car is about to come out. And so Piquet Jr. did it. He crashed his car at a place where they could not clear it without bringing out the safety car. And Alonso goes on to win. And even at the time, people thought it looked suspicious. It was one of those things where it was just kind of a weird accident to have. And then this was what really revealed how much these drivers are kind of in the FIA panopticon. Once the FIA investigators requested all the like telemetry and onboard data from the car, they basically had him. Like, they had enough evidence to judge that it was an intentional accident, because apparently there just was no evidence he had lost control of the car. Everything that had happened appeared to be predictable, like, inputs. And I thought that was kind of chilling in some ways. It's good they sussed it out, but once they got that data, it was clear what had happened. And then you sort of had the situation where Nelson Piquet, you know, it's prisoner's dilemma, interrogation type stuff. Nelson Piquet Jr. realizes like he's in deep shit with his racing career on the line. His dad gets involved. He ends up like diming out Flavio. I think Alonso ends up doing the same. And the result was Flavio Briatore was basically kicked out of the sport as far as being a team principal. But I want to say they fought really hard to allow him to remain an agent. And I don't know if they mandated he stop representation, but I do know that Alonso and might have been Mark Webber was represented by him. But there were a couple drivers who fought really hard to, you know, hey, look, we all make mistakes. Flavio rigged one race. Let him stay as our agent. It is infamous. It is one of the weirdest things that's happened in modern F1. It basically spelled the end of the Benetton-Renault team. It ended Briatore. But Briatore was sort of a force in the industry at the time. And it definitely ended Piquet Jr.'s shot at being an F1 driver.
Yeah, I've got some quotes here from the Wikipedia page, which were taken from a BBC article and an article from The Telegraph. Alonso denied knowing any plan to ask Piquet to crash, stating, quote, "I cannot imagine these things, these situations. It's something that never entered my mind." Nelson Piquet Jr. questioned whether Alonso knew that a crash was planned, citing that in his place, he would have questioned Renault's, quote, "senseless Alonso race strategy of starting with a low fuel load and making an early pit stop on the 12th lap. During the course of the investigation and before the WMSC hearing, Alonso was absolved of any blame by the FIA. And on 11 September, I think this is 2009, Max Mosley, the FIA president, confirmed that Piquet Jr. would face no action after making his two statements to the FIA in regards to this, even if the case was found in favor of Renault. So Piquet did not actually get reprimanded in any way. He just became persona non grata and left Formula One, went to Formula E, and has not been back to Formula One since.
Yeah. I remember, I want to say it was Jackie Stewart at the time who remarked that it was a sign to him. He was like, somebody asked Jackie Stewart, I want to say that, you know, well, in your day, do you think any drivers would have done it? And he was like, absolutely not. But then he followed up with something interesting. He said, of course, in my day, we were racing as grown men. You didn't start your F1 career at such an early date. And he's like, I don't know what we would have done if we'd been Nelson's age with those amount of expectations. And your boss tells you to do this, you know. A bunch of seasoned F1 drivers back in the day would have said, go to hell. Maybe a little tougher when you are recruiting straight out of sort of youth leagues. basically. And which I always thought was an interesting point. It hasn't come up again because I think this really underlined the degree to which this kind of cheating is impossible in F1, because if it doesn't smell right, other teams are going to call you on it, and then your car's data itself will betray you.
Yeah. Driver victories here are tied between Hamilton and Vettel with four each. Alonso has two, Nico Rosberg has one. And because the track is a tight street circuit and it's a slower lap, expect aerodynamics to be more important than horsepower this weekend. That means we shouldn't necessarily expect Ferrari to continue to dominate after their wins at Spa and Monza, but we might expect some good things from Red Bull, as well as Racing Point with their upgrade. Haas has said that they're going to try a hybrid between their old and new spec cars, but I think that's coming up in the next race, not in Singapore. Also, there was an article in Autosport saying that Mercedes has turned its engine back up since its introduction in Belgium and after it exploded a couple of times. Toto Wolff said to Autosport, no, we're not holding back on the engine modes anymore. So this might be a Red Bull-Mercedes race. But, you know, last year, Vettel was fighting Verstappen in the race, and I think lost it because of strategy. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't go back and watch it, but
also Mercedes was the one who was having temperature problems earlier this year. I don't know if they're solved, but
that's a good point.
The Mercedes, I don't know, the works Mercedes was definitely having heat problems. I don't know if that problem trickled down to the customer teams. Though they've also had engine reliability problems in the last couple weeks. But, yeah, I'm also just – that is another dimension to this. If this track is really running this hot and then Mercedes to eke every last bit of performance out of an engine that is maybe its best days are past it, I could see engine reliability being a factor here, separate from the, you know, paper performance of these engines.
Yeah, good point. And with all the braking that's going on, overheating is a very big possibility. Pirelli has said that the tire stress, lateral forces, and asphalt grip of this track are pretty low. Asphalt abrasion, though, they gave a 3 out of 5. We're taking the C3 hard tire, the C4 medium, and the C5 soft. So the softest tires that we have. Mercedes is taking 2 hards, 3 mediums. Ferrari's only taken 1 set of hard tires and 3 mediums, whereas Red Bull's taken 2 hards, 1 set of the mediums, and 10 soft tires. So they seem pretty confident with whatever their strategy is. And then it's kind of a mix from there. And poor Williams, they're splitting their hards 2 to 1, Russell Kubica, and then 4 to 5 medium tires and 7 each of the soft. So, that's what we got going on for tires. Weather-wise, oh boy, 30 degrees Celsius at qualifying time. That's 86 at qualifying time in Fahrenheit.
Well, at least it's a sopping heat.
Yeah, 65% humidity for the day, which I think can increase, I know can increase to 100%. Rain is not unexpected here, although it looks like this weekend pretty low chance for qualifying. It's only 3%, and for race day it's only 9%. But yeah, high temps, wind I don't think is much of a factor. Well, that's not true, they're right on the bay, so 10 mile an hour or 16 kilometers an hour for both race day and qualifying day. Yeah, that's gonna be gross. Let's take it through the driver standings here. Lewis Hamilton on top with 284. Valtteri Bottas behind him in second place with 221. Verstappen has 185. Leclerc, 182. Sebastian Vettel in fifth place with 169. Then we've got Gasly with 65. Sainz with 58. Ricciardo and Albon are tied for eighth place with 34 points. Danny Kvyat in 10th, right behind him with 33. Hülkenberg and Raikkonen both have 31. Perez with 27. Norris has 25. Stroll with 19. Magnussen with 18. Grosjean's got 8. Antonio Giovinazzi with 3 points. Robert Kubica with 1. And George Russell 0 points. In constructor standings, Mercedes has 505 points. Ferrari's got 351. Red Bull, 266. McLaren in fourth place currently with 83 points. Renault's got 65. Scuderia Toro Rosso, 51 points. Racing Point right behind with 46. Alfa Romeo's got 34 points. Gene Haas and team, 26 points in ninth place. And 10th is Williams with their Uno. In the Shift F1 Fantasy League, which you can join with the code in the show notes and the link, 10th place is G's Mercedes driver team, hedged by Ferrari. 9th place, Fry the Donuts. 8th place is To the Future Part 3. 7th place is Maca F1. And we've got 6th place, Defcon 1. 5th place, Mercedes All the Way. 4th place, Dragon Ball GT. Number 3, The Hamiltons Break the System. Number 2, Steering Wheel, Hey Hey, Give It to Me, Move, Come On. And number 1, Rich Volt F1 Energy Team, Paintwork Pending.
It feels like there's been some movement in that field.
Oh, yeah, it's all over the place. You know what? I think Albon's move really switched things up because you could get him for cheap on the week that they announced the move. He hadn't gone up in price to Red Bull dollars. So, yeah, a lot of scrambling of the field there. Let's take it to the emails. You can email us at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com. This one comes in from Travis, who says, "Hi, guys. Just checking in after another awesome race. I'm not sure if you guys get all the extra things that Sky F1 do to fill out time between practice sessions. So I thought I'd bring it to your attention." You are correct. We do not get all of that extra Sky F1 stuff. I've seen a fair bit of it on streamable.com. The pirating site du jour, I guess. But yeah, I love Ted's Notebook, what I've seen of that. But Travis goes on to say, "This time I thought it might be worth mentioning, as tech guys that you are, and after hearing it being mentioned a few times on the podcast this year, Sky broadcast an hour-long Ask Crofty section in which he interviewed a guy called David Hill, who is a TV consultant for Formula One. He explained that this year they are trying to get the viewer more involved with the racing, which is why we are hearing more crowd noises when things happen on track, as they've introduced way more trackside microphones. He was also saying about the microphones that used to be in the cockpit, which is where they did used to get the engine noises being picked up from." By the way, this was there is an old forum post on Giant Bomb from like 2013 where I basically ask a whole bunch of questions. I'll see if I can find it in the show notes. It's probably pretty funny. Like, I knew nothing about Formula One, so I basically asked the Giant Bomb audience, "Hey, here are all my questions. Please answer them for me." And one of them is, where do they put the microphones? And now I know. They used to be in the cockpit. But Travis says, "This year they managed to develop a new microphone that can sustain massively high temperatures, which they introduced into the exhaust of the cars to try to get the viewer to hear more of the engine and gear shift tones, and how they can differ between shifts up and down, and how different engines sound over runs. Anyway, sorry for the long essay here, but thought it might be of interest. Cheers, Travis from the UK." Thank you, Travis.
Yeah, I love to read about this stuff. I remember years ago there was this piece about, it was either Fox's main football broadcast, or it might have been Sunday Night Football, but it was all about the production setup for what one of the networks does for its biggest NFL game of the week. And it's all about things like, every arena is different. So where are you going to put crowd like microphones for picking up crowd noise? How do you want to mix all that audio? Where are you going to set up cameras for the best shots? And there's an aesthetic component to this as well, because like, if you watch games on CBS, for instance, they tend to like the announcers to be really loud, and the game always is kind of muted. They try to like have on-field noise, but not much crowd. And it's kind of this quiet, airless feeling of an NFL game, whereas Fox has always been very much about like getting crowd noise. And increasingly, I tend to be, for me, like, sound is immersion, especially because I've had a decent like surround setup for a while. And so to me, it sounds really weird when all you hear are basically commentators and like the center channel speaker, and you're watching something really exciting, but you don't get any of that like sympathetic excitement from like that you get with a crowd. But if you have crowd noise, that does sort of create the feeling of you're seeing an awesome live sporting event. I think one thing I wish Sky would maybe do differently is it feels to me like mostly they're interested in crowd noise only insofar as it fits a narrative of Max's Dutch fans being there and excited to see him do well. Like, it is this recurring beat of, like, Max does something on the track and, like, clockwork, you love Crofty being like, and he gets an amazing cheer from all these orange-clad Dutch fans here to see their man take the check. It's like, surely the crowd is also reacting to other stuff. And so I wish maybe the decision were a little more just open up what it sounds like in those stands than they do. I was wondering about the engine thing, because I thought this year they did sound like, I was surprised how often this year I've been thinking, oh, that doesn't sound right. You know, like you can hear a little bit more like shifts going wrong or engines seeming off song. And I thought maybe I was just getting better at hearing that. But, well, I guess in some ways I am, because that, now there's a microphone.
Yeah, and I have even started to be able to tell the engines apart.
Oh, yeah.
Which is something I never thought I would be able to do. But yeah, I always wondered why we didn't hear wind noise. Like, where is this mic? It's just engine. It's great. But yeah, thanks for that, Travis. And if you'd like to email us as well, you can do so at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at shiftf1podcast. I am at Drew Scanlon. That's at Rob Zachney. Danny O'Dwyer is at Danny O'Dwyer. Let's take it around the world of racing, shall we, Rob?
Let's do it.
Friday, the NASCAR Xfinity Series is in Richmond, Virginia, at the Richmond Raceway for the Go Bowling 250. IndyCar is at Laguna Seca for this is their final round, I think, of this year. MotoGP is in Motorland Aragon in Teruel, Spain. All of these sound like Lord of the Rings places. MXGP, the Motocross Grand Prix, is in Hong Kong at the Central Harbor Front event space for the MXGP of Hong Kong. Super GT is at Sportsland Sugo in...
You looking at a prefecture?
Is Miyagi a prefecture?
Hang on, I am actually down this rabbit hole of what is Go Bowling? And it appears to maybe be an advocacy group for bowling.
Like, okay.
Like, hey, you should go bowling. Yeah, dude, like, it asked for my zip code, and it just gave me a list of bowling alleys in my area, but it wasn't like they were Go Bowling locations. It was just bowling alleys near me. So this might be, like, the Dairy Farmers Association of bowling alleys or something like that, where, like, they just want to spread the good word about bowling and why you should do it. And if you're curious, there's resources. So if you go to the gobowling.com website, you can click on learn. And want to know how? Watch the videos. Then get to a lane and practice from sun up till sundown. Sleep, eat, bowl, baby.
Does this say baby?
Yes, dude, it does. Like, this is the purest site. You have, like, this is such a good website. It seems so wholesome. I want to go bowling because of this. but it does also seem like, is bowling okay? Like, this feels like the sort of move where, like, bowling alley owners are like, shit, like, all our clients are dropping dead of heart attacks or, like, are just retiring to Florida. So what do we do here? And apparently this is the play. It's gobowling.com.
Sponsor a NASCAR race. That's the play. Sportsland Sugo, a motorsports facility in the town of Murata, Shibata District, Miyagi Prefecture, Japan. And we got NASCAR. The regular kind, not the not the Boland kind. They're also in Richmond for the Federated Auto Parts 400.
By God. Where are the trucks? Are the trucks done or are the trucks still racing?
Trucks may have concluded. Nope, I'm wrong. There's a race in October.
Hell yeah.
Don't worry. Formula One also this weekend. Maybe you've heard of it. Practice starts Friday, September 20th at, wow, we got some weird times, 4:25 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2, followed by Practice 2 at 8:25 a.m. Practice 3, Saturday, September 21st at 5:55 a.m. And then qualifying at 8:55 a.m. That's very watchable qualifying. 9 a.m. qualifying on the East Coast, that's noon over here. That's great. And then the race, Rob Zachney, Sunday, September 22nd at 8:05 a.m. on ESPN2, the deuce. I'm excited. It's only been 2 weeks, but I feel like I've been missing my F1. And I like Singapore. I like looking at it. And there's always a chance of safety car. So cloudy with a chance of safety car.
So it's tricky to pick a new bowling ball that's got the right weight for you. But hopefully they do have different colors to correspond with those weights. But a lot of bowlers, the first time they end up buying or picking up a ball that is too light for them. And the other thing you really want to be careful about when you're determining the right weight is making sure your fingers and your thumb go in easily. Shouldn't be tight. It should be loose.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/shiftf1. That's it for us. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.
Of course, it was always bowling when Pastor was driving.